Welcome to the Emotional Horsemanship Podcast. I am your host, Lockie Phillips, and I help deeply caring equestrians create emotionally balanced horses with science, empathy, and feel. This podcast is a safe place for anyone who desires a better future for horses and for the equestrian lifestyle. I hope that you will enjoy these solo and collaborative episodes where we enjoy a deep insight into our horses' worlds and ways in which we can make that better for them. If you love horses and are willing to do right by them, you're going to love this podcast. And I thank you for being here. Bettina Biolik is a horse riding instructor and horse trainer currently situated near Warsaw, Poland. She says that she teaches people from all corners of the world how to connect better with their horses, how to develop their timing and feel, and understand of and their skill in dressage exercises. Bettina is a member of the Knighthood of Academic Art of Riding and is a licensed bent brander-up trainer. Bettina and I used to cross paths when we lived in Warsaw at the same time, though it is not until now that we paid much attention to the other or had an opportunity to get to know one another. The conversation that Bettina and I had that you are about to listen to, I personally really enjoyed. I enjoyed Bettina's even-keel approach to difficult questions because she is so open, so balanced, and so friendly that I felt safe to ask her some more difficult questions that I used to have about dressage and that many of my clients and perhaps you might have about dressage. So I'll say it for you. And she took these difficult questions in stride and brought a lot of elegance to her answers. And after the recording, she thanked me for taking her there to this place and creating a safe place to explore difficult questions. So, Bettina, thank you, thank you, thank you for trusting me enough to go there with you and for being so open with me in this conversation. And I hope you enjoy this talk as well. Hi, Bettina. How are you doing today?
Hello, Lucky. I'm wonderful. I'm super excited to be here with you.
I'm so happy to have you here too. I consider you one of my new old friends because we sort of ran past each other in Poland years ago when we were in Warsaw at the same time. But since I was on the Horse Talk podcast with you from the Academic Art of Riding platform, I was so impressed by your gentle, soft-spoken nature that came across in our conversation. And I so respect any professional who is trying to do something good for horses and good for people. And I certainly see you in that category. So it was a natural to have you back when I decided to start my own podcast. And I'm really happy that you're here.
Thank you. You can't see that now because I wear headphones, but I have a little bit red ears now.
So, you know, last time we spoke, it was a little bit more about me, which is deeply boring. But
only for you. I think for other people, it's very interesting.
But like for anyone who doesn't know you, who are you? What do you do? And how do you do it? That's a big question, but just start rambling. Share with us who you are,
what
you
do. All right, I start rambling. Who am I? I'm Bettina. I try to bring horses and people closer together. You could say I'm a horse riding instructor. I do have a license as a Ben Brandrup trainer, so my specialty is academic art of riding, which I consider dressage with a lot of feel, and a dressage that is really good for the horse, which I think is a really, really important thing in the time that we live in. So that's what I do. Who am I is a little bit of a longer question.
We have time. I'd love to hear more about who you are.
Yeah, it's a question that I have been wondering my whole life. And I know that you are very much onto homecoming at the moment. And that's something that has been intriguing me very much. And since I've read about that on your page and we had our talk in the podcast that I did, it has got me thinking a lot about what it means for me. And I found out that I had so many homecoming moments in my life. And I think this is also what informs my horsemanship, because I really do believe that I cannot be somebody else with my horses than I am in life. For me, there's no difference being with horses and being alive and living and being who I am. So I don't know if you don't mind. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. Homecoming is a online course and program that I have. I ran it for the first time last year from September through to December last year. It was 12 weeks. And it was in my head like an unfinished symphony for a long time before I found the time and place and frankly also the internet connection to be able to do it, because it ended up being this 12-week long mega course where I showed emotional horsemanship intermediate techniques in a progressive way with a lot of theory, a lot of emotional neuroscience, and in a community program. So it was a course that I did, and I called it Homecoming because for me, that's what emotional horsemanship feels like for me. I go on journeys. I've journeyed in Academic Art of Riding. I've journeyed in Intrinsen, for example.
Kathy Sierra, interesting.
I actually just had an interview with her before I was speaking to you. So I'm speaking to both of you on the same day, which is fascinating. And I've had a journey around, you know, long distance trail riding and journey during Portuguese dressage for a little while. And I've sort of bounced around a bit, but it's a feeling, yes. Whether you do dressage, jumping, or you don't even ride your horse at all and you keep them safe in your backyard, it's this feeling of comfort. It's this feeling of being at home in your body and with your horse. And it's one of the biggest problems that I see in the people that I work with. But when you hear the word homecoming, and we discussed that concept of being at home, what does that mean for you?
For me, that really started when I was a teenager, like in my late teens, because I had always, you know, I always had a really deep love for animals, for all sorts of animals. Also, like even as a kid, I helped worms cross the road after the rain, you know, that kind of thing. And one of the most traumatic experiences of my childhood was when a neighbor kid took some snails, you know, the big ones with the big house, and put them in front of car tires so that when the cars would start, they would get smashed. And she found that really amusing. And that was, for me, that was so shocking that people would treat animals like that. So for me, I started horse riding, as a child, and we didn't have our own horses, so I tried to go with my friends to their horses and also learned in riding schools. And I was really not very happy by the way how horses were treated already when I was a kid. Yeah. And I did not understand why the forcefulness and why those animals have to be treated in a different way. So I often perceived people treating their pets at home with a lot of loving care. And then they, you know, with their horses, they would be very rough at times and say, okay, no, you have to do it like this. And otherwise you're going to end up doing this all the time and stuff like that. Then there were some events when I was a teenager that really changed my life. And the first one was that I met a horse riding instructor who was for this time very kind of progressive, I would say. So he had a small farm where he lived with his horses, and he did riding therapy. So And I called him up one day because I wanted to work at a horse farm during my holidays, because that's usually what I did. So I didn't have a lot of money, so I always worked for lessons. And we ended up having a 1.5 hour conversation about horse training. And I think I was 16 or something like that. Yeah. And he trained with people like, I don't know if you know, Klaus Ferdinand Hempfling. Also, Klaus Penquit, he was one of his inspirations. So I don't know if he trained personally with him. And he also was very inspired by Lynette Tallington. Yeah. So the, those people were very, how to say, alternative in that time. And now we consider them just, you know,
stepping stones.
Stepping stones. Yeah. But back then it was like, wow. Yeah. So
he gave me
some books to read. And he taught me the basics of T-touch, for example. And he would, our riding lessons were just mind blowing. They were, he would ask me questions such as, how do you stop a horse? And then I would answer. And he's like, yeah, okay, but what do you do first? And is it really this what you do first? And he was really questioning what I did, and that really helped me understand a lot of things. And we had our riding lessons always out in nature, so he didn't have an arena back then. So we would do our dressage work on fields and in the forest. And he also gave me a little rehabilitation project. So a horse named Nico, I still remember the name, and that horse had really lost trust in humans. And my homework was to help Nico trust people again, which I think is no small homework for a teenager. And it was really amazing because, this guy, he showed me, he kind of trusted me with that horse, and he gave me responsibility. You know, when I was just a kid, yeah. And that kind of, together with the gentle way of how he was teaching people and horses. So we did also ground work. Yeah. A lot of it inspired by Lynette Tallington. And that really, I loved that. And I loved that change. Yeah. And I felt very much at home with this. So the change from being in those riding schools where things were often a little bit rough. Yeah. And you had to use the whip to beat the pony when it didn't go fast enough. Yeah. And things like that. And yeah, he did things like he even went on holidays with his family, and he left me in charge of the stable, you know, which is, you know, that's big when you're a teenager. It's like, whoa,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, and then, so that was really amazing. Yeah. And this, with this guy, we also talked about other things, not only horse riding. There were often things about just life in general. And I had been a kid that always had a lot of questions about life in general, like what happens when we die? Or I was wondering that, I remember one day I stood by my window and I thought, well, I have this view about reality. I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing everything from my perspective. And everybody that is on the street down there has the same. They see things from their perspective. So whose perspective is it now? Which is what is true? Is everything true or none of it? Yeah, so that were the things that I was wondering about. And my mom was often like, oh, come on. So anyway, this horse riding instructor, one day he bought me some tickets for a Buddhist lecture. And I was, I don't remember, I was 17 or 18 at that time. So I went with my boyfriend. And I must say that, yeah, I entered this lecture hall, and there were so many friendly people there. It was just such a nice atmosphere. And the teacher was Lama Oda Nydal. He's a Danish Buddhist Lama. Yeah, and I was sitting there, and everything that he said made sense. And suddenly all my questions had stopped, and I felt like I was at home. Yeah, so and this feeling has never left me. And I think this is also the perspective that I'm looking at, looking through when I'm working with horses and with people and with myself, that for me, that perspective on life that Buddhism gives me, I find very valuable. And especially the kindness and compassion, you know, that essentially all beings want to have happiness, and they all want to avoid suffering. And sometimes we go about it in really stupid ways, but we don't do it because we're mean, but because we think that will bring us happiness. Yeah, so that might be sometimes difficult to think like that when you also now you look at all this footage from those people who mistreat horses, and you think, oh man, come on.
Yeah.
Who does that? You know, who does that?
A lot of people do that. Do you still call yourself, are you a Buddhist? Do you call yourself a Buddhist?
Yes, yeah.
You are. Yeah. You are a practicing Buddhist. That is your religion?
Yes, I am. Exactly.
I did not know that about you.
Yeah. I don't really make this very public. I think religion is a private thing. And I think people should do what makes them happy. That's just my personal opinion. I also know that, I don't know. For me, it's also important that all of my students feel welcomed. And it's not like because I have a certain religion, people might think I might not welcome them or something like that. So it's something I do. And it's just such a part of me that I don't need to, I don't need to put it out there all the time. So I think it's might be the first time I'm mentioning it here on this podcast with you.
Well, thank you for feeling safe to tell us. If you look on my screen, right where my finger is pointing here, this is a little sign. I purchased this sign probably about 15 years ago when I was in Innsbruck in Austria. I wandered into a Tibet shop in Innsbruck in the Alps. And it's a little sign. It's a quote from the Dalai Lama. And it says, I'm going to tell you what it says. Hold, please.
Yes, I'm holding.
And I've moved around a lot in 15 years. I've lived in all sorts of countries, had all sorts of things going on. But I've always kept this sign with me. And when I set up my office here at home, it was one of the first things I put up on my wall. And it says, loving kindness. Right from the moment of our birth, we are under the care and kindness of our parents. And then later on in our life, when we are oppressed by sickness and become old, we are again dependent on the kindness of others. Since at the beginning and end of our lives, we are so dependent on others' kindness, how can it be that in the middle we neglect kindness towards others, the Dalai Lama? So I've always had that in everywhere I've lived. And to hear you then sit here and say, hey, I'm a Buddhist. And I'm like, well, I've got this thing that I've kept with me everywhere I go.
With a beautiful quote. Really
with
beautiful.
A beautiful quote. And yeah. About, fun fact, this is like not even important, but I sort of met the Dalai Lama about 10 years ago in Warsaw. He was in Warsaw. So one morning I walked into the National Opera House, into Teatr Wielki, and I walked through the stanchions, the security stanchions. And usually you just walk through, you scan your card and you walk through. But this day there were people there doing a metal detection check on you and they wanted to look inside your bag. And it was like a Thursday and I was tired and I was just like, what is going on? I work here. Leave me alone. I'd felt completely bugged by it. I went upstairs and I walked to my dressing room. There was always things happening in the theater and there's a big crowd of people next to the elevators. And I looked at the crowd and I walked past and then I stopped and walked backwards. And standing there at the elevators was the Dalai Lama talking to Sharon Stone, the actress. And I'm sitting there thinking, am I high? Like, what is going on? What is even happening? And I went upstairs and I went to go to class and I said to my colleagues, I was like, is the Dalai Lama downstairs? And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, are none of you people freaking out about that? Like, why are you all so blasé about it? They're like, oh, there's some Nobel Peace Prize laureates meeting and they were using the Grand Theater as their venue. Anyway, so that was kind of weird and exciting.
It's so funny because I also met the Dalai Lama at an elevator once. So
stop it. You didn't.
I did.
Okay,
yeah.
So we have more in common. There are random little threads that are occurring here, Bettina.
It seems to be. It seems maybe life is giving us a nudge, like, hey.
This person. Okay. All right. So this feeling of home, the thing that made my mind blow was when you said, there was a moment when all the questions just stopped.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming those questions stopped not because you felt like, oh, I have all the answers now.
I don't have all the answers, that's for sure.
It's this feeling, and it's not because you're not curious. It's a different feeling that I struggle to describe, this feeling of being in your body and calling everything back to yourself to say, yeah, I can be curious, but at what point does curiosity kill the cat? You know, at what point does curiosity take you out of yourself and into the world in ways which aren't meant for you? And that's kind of what homecoming is for me. It's like, yeah, not some journeys need to be taken, but not all journeys need to be taken. For example, when we look at those egregious training practices, and you said here, you know, who does that? Well, who does do that? People who do that, have they started many years ago with one idea, one problem, and then they got curious about the problem and they took the next step, and then they took the next step, and then they took the next step. And next thing you know, they're far down this journey where they're now attaching all of these things to horses and hitting them with sticks to create what? Lightness on the forehand? Is it really worth it? And by the way, is it really lightness on the forehand? So these are people who have journeyed to that place. And was that a journey they needed to take? These are the questions that I ask myself. But when I'm with my horses, I have very few questions sometimes, very few. Just there.
Yeah, that's true. For me, it has a lot to do with a certain kind of trust. Trust into, I would almost say, life itself. And I would say trust into space. Like trust in space, you know. So from what I really like about Buddhist philosophy is that there is a lot more that connects us than that separates us. So, and that we think about space, the space between us, as a connector, not as something that separates us. And that there is, space is full of information, so it's not empty. In itself, there are things happening. Yeah, so it's empty of being a certain kind of something. So when you hear talk about Buddhism and emptiness, people always think, oh, it means it's nihilism, that there's nothing. But this is not true. It's just empty of, for example, empty of an ego or a self. Yeah, and a certain point that you can shoot at, that you can trigger. Yeah, but it is empty, and at the same time, there are things going on. So joyfulness, yeah, there's wisdom. Yeah, so, coming home has to do with trust and, yeah, trusting life itself, I would say. That it doesn't mean that everything is always the way I want it, or that even everything turns out to be fine. I don't think this is what it means, but that everything is an experience and it's up to me to make it into something. And I can decide. So I can decide about the way how I see things. And that is something that I feel very, makes me feel very liberating. It's a liberating feeling. That's what I wanted to say. So that it is up to me. And I also try to, this is what I try to incorporate when I'm with my horses as well. So anything that happens to me there, I try to think about, I can decide, you know, I can decide to now take the stick and hit the pony, and I can decide to not do it. And I can decide to reflect. I can try to take a distance to things and think, hey, maybe I can find a better way. And why do I get angry right now? Mm. You know, why am I impatient? Look at that. I get impatient right now.
Right, and that's why I call what I do emotional horsemanship, because that question that you just asked here metaphorically is the very essence of the question that I believe separates horse people from horse people. It's the one that separates the ones that are harming horses and the ones that aren't. It's the ability to say, stop. Why does this make me feel like this? Can I understand that feeling? Can I control that feeling? Can I be appropriate and trustworthy around my horse and then explore tools with the animal? Yes?
Yes. Yeah. For me, that's a big part of being with horses, is to know yourself. And that's not, you know, that is not an easy thing. So, and it also does it, I think it requires a certain braveness to look inside and to see what's going on there, because you might not like what you see, and a deep honesty about yourself. So I think, and I do think that horses put us in touch with these things, just as meditation does. So for me, meditation and horsemanship have so many things in common. For me it is, to work on yourself is not always easy, because, you know, it's not like I have only five rosy thoughts before breakfast and then 10 beautiful ones after, you know. So to examine yourself, to see really what's there. And yeah, like you said in the beginning, who am I actually, really? Who am I when I get under pressure? Who am I when things are going well? This is easy. You know, when things are going well, it's easy to be nice and to be relaxed. But what happens when I get out of my comfort zone? And when you train horses, you do get out of your comfort zone. And if you never get out of your comfort zone, I don't think that you really train horses, because I think that's a bit the nature of working with horses. There will always be something for you to work on. Whenever you think you've got this figured out, then there comes this one horse or one student that you're like, oh man, I can't help these people. This student and this horse, what do I do? You know, I need to look around, learn something else, refer them to somebody, try to think, come up with a way of how to solve this, this situation. Or you meet some barriers within yourself that you're like, I don't know how to handle this. That makes me mad, or I get really confused here, and things like that. And so maybe that's why I'm so happy that I can do what I do, because it just feels life and horses, this is just one big thing. And it's so, it fits so beautifully together. You know, all those questions I had when I was a kid and working with horses, it's just, it's all coming together. And that's why I also really love the academic art of riding, because it gave me so many answers as well for different sorts of questions, maybe, but let's say questions when it comes to how to build up education, how to teach people, how to teach horses, questions about biomechanics and things like that. Yeah? And that I am allowed to be myself. I don't become a copy of somebody else and their method, but I can take what the academic art of riding has to offer, and I can integrate it into my very own being, and can use it in the way that, yes, Bent is teaching me, so our master Ben Brando, but also I have a certain freedom to be myself within all of this. And this was for me another big homecoming in a way. Yeah, so I was, when I bought my first own horse, I was really looking for a teacher around me who can teach me dressage. And then during one lesson, I filmed myself just like that. It was many years ago, so it was not really, we didn't have PIVA or anything like that. I asked my husband to film me. And I looked at that video later and I actually cried, because I could see the eyes of my horse and I could see that I made him suffer. And it was not my intention. I didn't know, you know. And that was a big, big shock for me, I must say, because I really loved my horse. Yeah, then I was started searching around for a method, how I can, because I just love dressage, you know, how I can ride dressage and my horse will be okay with it, will be happy with it and even thrive with it, develop, you know, get some new abilities and wait for me by the fence when I come for training. So I was just really thrilled to find that in the academic art, I must say.
It's beautiful to hear you describe all the parts and pieces of your journey to this place. I think it's so important that when we love a thing, like you continue to love dressage, that you were willing to let the image of it go, at least for a moment, in search of perhaps a better teacher. I think a lot of people hold on to their coach, their trainer, their training methods because they love the idea of what they're doing, but the practicality of what they're doing sometimes presents a lot of problems for the animal. What can you say? This is just an imagined scenario, but if you hadn't have found academic art of riding, where would you have gone from there? If there was no system of teaching dressage that is so elegant and nice for the animal like academic art of riding is, if you hadn't had that at your fingertips, do you have an awareness of what might have happened? It's all guesswork, but...
Yeah, I don't know. I might have never gone really into horse training, might have kept my horse and tried to do as best as I could, but maybe not really go into teaching people and horses. That's my best guess. So
it's an important, for me, that's a really important question, because sometimes I wonder why folks hold on to the things they hold on to. And what you've been describing here is really horsemanship. When you said that horse training and life, they are connected, a lot of us call that horsemanship. I've been saying for a while now that horsemanship is the gateway drug to personal development and understanding yourself.
Yeah. You know,
and horses aren't a really great pastime. They're not a great pastime for people who don't enjoy introspection, who don't enjoy accountability, who don't enjoy hardship, who don't enjoy these things. We shouldn't really be working with horses because, frankly, horses are large, dangerous creatures. The best of us, especially the best of us, will fall and hurt ourselves sometimes, eventually. It's going to happen. And there's a limit to how much we can do or should be doing with our animals. And some of us, some of our clients, some of our friends are a little bit like Titanics. I call it a Titanic problem. And it's the question I constantly ask myself as a horse person is, what do I not know that I don't know right now?
What I love that.
Am I headed for? What am I headed for?
The thing is, you don't know it until you know it.
Well, I really am. I'm very, very invested personally, at a personal level, in keeping my foot over the brakes as much as I can so that I can discover these things as I go, and being exceptionally analytical about what we do and why, and taking a very, very close microscope to everything the horse offers us and gives us as we're doing it, especially when we think, this is it. This is the nirvana of training. This is the leverage tool I finally needed. This is the thing that's going to solve all my problems. When you find one of those things and you feel that way about it, that's when we put it under the electron microscope and say, yeah, is this the unsinkable Titanic here? What's the problem in this? And I've had some weird instances with even my students where very quickly they'll try and present what I'm offering them as the solution to all their problems. And I'll say straight away, oh, but here are the problems with it. And they'll go, what? I'll say, yeah, this isn't perfect. And they'll go, oh, and they're kind of crestfallen. It's like, well, we need to have that level of responsibility to look at the things we love and understand that there are problems with it, that it's imperfect. Are you able to do that about academic art of riding? Are you able to look at that system and understand what's imperfect about it as well as perfect?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Would you like to share anything, any of those awarenesses with us?
What's imperfect about the academic art of riding?
Sure, yeah. Why not, you know?
I wouldn't say... Well, first thing I want to say is that it is a system that's very open to change.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep,
I think
it is
made up of individuals who are all extremely invested into their horsemanship. So I haven't met a single person in the academic art of riding who's not asking themselves the big questions. Am I doing the right thing? Is this really okay for my horse? And things like that, yeah. And I do love that it is developing all the time. The academic art of riding was not the same when I started like it is now. Definitely.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so Yeah, I mean, for me, it's sometimes I wish there would be a little more, even more, I would say, about the connection to the horse in the sense of where some problem come from, like that they are, for example, caused by that the animal can be a bit overwhelmed right now. So let's say if we talk about bending, why does the horse lose the bending? And because in each case, the fix might be a different one. So let's say the horse is overwhelmed and needs a break and he's looking away from me to just tell me, whew, you know, a lot of information right now. Then the solution would be to give a break, maybe to do a little bit less intense. Maybe the level of the exercise for this moment is not appropriate. And then to see if the horse would like to connect to me because I do less and I give him maybe the knowledge in smaller packages or something, or the task in a smaller package. But maybe it is a biomechanical problem that the horse is leaning a lot on an inside front leg. Then I would need an indirect rein and help the horse rebalance in the forehand. But why does he do that all the time? So is he trying to avoid picking up weight with a hind leg? And that's why he's pushing weight onto a shoulder. So then we have to go look at, do we find any pathologies there? Maybe.
So I'm hearing you say that the academic art of riding systems sometimes could improve discovering the root cause of problems in the training. Is that what you're saying?
I think so. And I think that's something that we're onto right now. That's why I'm hesitating a little bit, because this is actually what we're doing right now. So at the moment, many of my colleagues are meeting in small groups, which is something that is not going on like publicly, but it's going over Zoom meetings and Skype meetings where they discuss causes, like, for example, gait analysis and causes of pain and things like that, body language of horses, pain signals. And that's something that is going on right now. You're talking about the different, for example, we have during our summer academy this summer, we'll have the topic, the bending of the haunches. So right now, everybody's looking into the different joints. What is their optimal angle of functioning? What are pathologies? And how can we tell, you know, things like that? And how do different joints work together and the muscle groups around there? And so that's why I'm a bit hesitating with this question, because for me,
you don't want to misrepresent something that you love. I understand that.
It's not even about that, but it is the feeling that I have about things that could improve are improving already. You know what I mean? So it is in progress. And it's because all of us, each individual, is working on it. Yeah, so every single rider, we're kind of aware of some things, and we try to make it better. And I think this is just really amazing. It's not like the system is like this and period. It's like we're adapting also with the modern science. That we have I have a lot of amazing colleagues who are really deep into science, actually doing actual research, or that are really good osteopaths and stuff like that. Yeah? So they are like, hey, come on, we can do this better. Let's work on it as a group. And then we often meet in smaller groups when we have our meeting, for example, at Summer Academy, and we talk, and it's like, hey, this is something I would like to bring in, and then people actually do it. So, And it is also that I really very appreciate the academic art of riding, and I really think that it is going in a really good way. So,
yeah, I agree with you. Like, if I have a client who wants to learn dressage, that is probably the only place where I think they are safe to go learn it. When I wanted to explore classical work a little bit more deeply, that's where I went. And it was an incredibly interesting experience to touch bases with it. I'm a big believer in going outside of my circle to gather information from experts who aren't already confirming the things I already believe. So I love speaking with people who are really, really different to me. I love speaking with people who have a totally different voice, totally different perspective, and maybe even disagree with me. I love speaking with them because that's where I feel like I'm going to get the most healthy learning. That's where I feel like I'm going to find something new rather than circling back to confirm things that I already know. That's how I love to do it. So I remember I can share with you personally some really interesting examples.
Oh, please, yes.
my horse, Sani, when we started doing some of the academic work with him, he was just like, oh, love it, because he was already the relationship he and I have and the level of work we'd already done together had really set him up to be so ready for me to say to him, use that body part like this and only this right now, to be that specific with him. He was very, very ready and he wanted to please and he was very interested, but I was still able to have more quote unquote ugly modern trainings with him where we could be way more compensatory in the body and do other sorts of things as well. So I was able to kind of cross train by adding in the academic system, and I found a really nice balance in his body. And he got along with it really well. And my friend who was teaching me, at first she looked at Sani and she's like, you want to do this with him? And she's like, that's not the horse for it. But when she saw him work with me, her eyes lit up. She was like, oh my God, you could make rapid progress with him very, very quickly with this system. So that was really fun. But then I brought in my ex-dressage horse who is in the competitive dressage world. And he was just like, he thought I was asking him to do all the things that he had been doing in the past, but you're doing right. them in like a weird way. And he was just like, leave me alone with this. Yeah, Take that away. Like, fuck off. So I had like one training where we tried to make it work and he was just looking at me going, stop it. Would you stop this shit? Like, just stop it. So I asked him to like chase me and play with me and to jump around and, you know, get it out of his system. And I said, okay. I said to my friend who was teaching me, we're just going to put him to the side for now, even though he's got all the talents and the looks, put him to the side. I need more time with him doing my stuff with him to build him to that place where he can be available for this very, very advanced work that the academic system introduces, which is incredibly precise, incredibly nuanced, very, very quiet work, which requires a lot of maturity from some horses. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. Mm.
Let's take a break. If you are curious to watch an emotional horsemanship lesson with real students from around the world, you can explore that on the Emotional Horsemanship Video Library. The Emotional Horsemanship Video Library is hosted on Patreon, which is a platform where twice per week, new educational materials are released for you to study, learn from, and enjoy. The biggest benefit of the video library is both the broad scope of subjects explored, but also your ease of access, because you can start anytime and stop anytime. The platform supports freshly updated software on both your PC or even on a smartphone app, and you can even get a 10% discount for annual subscriptions. As we step towards an international recession, it is so important that we find ways to learn, teach, and grow as horse people within safe spaces while still leaving enough for us to take care of ourselves and our horses properly. And it is my intention to continue making the best educational materials that I can for you every week, twice per week, to support you and your horse if you choose to join us. You can explore the content with a lot of freedom, or you can take a look at collections, which organize the tutorials into groupings housed under a specific subject. Subjects such as foundational groundwork, lessons with students, clips from clinics, horse care and handling tutorials, trimming tutorials, and even behind-the-scenes information about how emotional horsemanship is growing amongst a community of horse-centric human beings who wish to train more quietly, patiently, and selflessly. Your subscription to the Emotional Horsemanship Video Library enables me to bring free educational, thought-provoking, community-building, and entertaining content to you, such as this podcast. And I thank you for considering to join us there. Okay, let's return to Bettina Biolik, who continues to bring so much elegance to harder conversations. And I'm so grateful for her for doing so. It's incredibly nuanced, very, very quiet work, which requires a lot of maturity from some horses. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. Mm. But we do start with very basic work as well, too, because to gain the connection to the horse is part of the academic work. It's not like, for me, the academic work doesn't start when the horse is in the arena, ready to listen, feel safe. But I also use it to connect to the horses and to get their attention and to create a safe space for learning. So that's what I use the academic art for as well. So,
I think almost anything can be a connection technique when we bring that intention to it.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it is about my intention, my softness, you know, the picture that I have of it. And for me, this is how I see it, that horses are very good with inner pictures. So what I have in my mind, I think it's easy for them to read it. And so that's what I will do a lot in the beginning. I will do little things, like explaining some signals, or we'll just do leading training with the horse. I do a lot of leading training. Personally with my horses, also, for example, going outside for walks. Yeah. But let's say I'm in a lesson situation, then, when I have a feeling that a horse is not ready for, like you said, the more advanced work, I will not do it, because it will only create brace in the horse. And I want them to love it. I want them nothing short of loving it. You know, that they see a cavesson and they're like, you know, we're doing this again. And when this is not the case, I have questions about my approach, and it really bothers me like hell when I have a student and they say, you know, still not making progress with this. The horse is still kind of nipping the rope or gets spooky, or it bothers me like hell, because it means that I haven't found the right way for this horse to explain it, so that he can feel safe, yeah, and be really open and joyful for things, because I think this work is so cool, right? So the feeling I want horses to have for this kind of work as well. And when they don't have it, it's not art for me, because on purpose, there is this word art in the academic art of riding. It's not only academic riding, it's academic art of riding. So, and when it's only one of us wanting this, and maybe I don't even have an idea about what I want and how I want it, it's not art. Yeah. So, and it's, for me, it's that inner softness and that inner yes of the horse that makes the art. And that can be that he really understands how to follow the feel of an inside rein. And he's just following it softly with his thoughts and with his body. And then I'm like, oh, that's beautiful. And that's art for me. So that doesn't start with Piaffe or something. It starts with the simple things, the reaction for an aid, that the horse really knows what is this about. And that they really want to do it, and not like, yeah, I'm doing it because I know there's going to be consequences if I don't. Yeah, and even if the consequence is, you're just not going away. Okay, so I'll do it. Yeah. So, and what I often see is dressage work is not art. It's making a horse do something. It can look spectacular. And then, as you said earlier, the question is it really that spectacular? Is it a freedom in the shoulder? Is it just a marionette, you know, throwing legs around? Is that actually beautiful? And that is certainly not art. Yeah. And when you ask me to book an appointment that we talk about here in this, I landed on a page where you explained a little bit about what you might want to talk about. And you said something about mucking out some things.
We're going to get to that segment.
Hold that thought.
Because I promise I'm gonna take you there to that segment.
Okay.
I love everything that you're saying, and it's my point of view to always present a different point of view. My different point of view sometimes outside looking in. Sometimes outside looking in, not always, off the academic art of writing system, sometimes. And I don't think this is you, but this is the concern of the system that I've had others also express to me. And I'm sharing it with you not to be combative, but I share it with you as colleagues.
You can totally go ahead. It's fine.
I share it with you. So you know how you have Coca-Cola with full sugar, full caffeine, and then you have Diet Coca-Cola? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, it's better for you because there's no sugar. And then mm-hmm. you have diet caffeine-free Coca-Cola. It's like, what even is that? What even is that anymore? I'm concerned in the human tendency to take something like full-blown horrific dressage, you know, like the bad, heavy, forceful type of dressage that we see that's forcing horses into it. And it's very, very obvious. That's Coca-Cola. I'm concerned some people sometimes have looked for gentler diet ways of doing the same thing. So it's just softly, softly forcing the horse, but it's still forcing the horse. It's just softly, softly with the tap of a stick saying, nope, you don't have any other choice. Give me that. Give me that. Give me that. I call it, it's the difference between a slap across the face and pecking like a hen at something. Peck, 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 peck. And when my friend was here, who I adore her, and she works with Mariusz very deeply, when she was here teaching me the academic art of writing system, I was very, very clear at every moment in our lesson to make sure that never became part of the picture. And she was wonderful because she's also a Reiki practitioner, so she brings that element to it as well. And I discovered that there was so much in the academic art of writing system that felt like home to me. But as an outsider looking in, and I don't see you doing this, and I don't think you teach this, but as an outsider looking in, I have seen that. Maybe I didn't know what I was looking at. Maybe I'm an idiot. But sometimes I've seen that. And that's been my concern, is that sometimes we just seek to do a diet version of the same thing, or disguise it better, or to make it nicer force. But really, it's still not integrating fully the concept of, why does the horse have to do these things? Oh, because we're preparing them for riding. Okay, why do we have to ride them? Why is that? Because I want to. Ah, right there, because you want to. Does the horse want to? When the tail's going quitch, 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 and every science we have said that this is a conflict signal, that the horse has a problem.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so these are the questions I try to answer, and I'm very, very careful about them, extremely careful about them. And I think a lot of people are careful about them. It's easy to throw people like Cesar Parra into the volcano and never see him again. That's easy, because you look at that and you go, oh, there's no question
exactly, yeah.
at all that that's a problem for most of us. But when we see lighter versions of force coming forward, that's a lot harder to deal with, because there's two truths at the same time. There's a lot of good. There's so much technique. There's love for the horse. There's so much good. And then there'll be something which is left over from a previous system, a previous paradigm, which either the person or the people in charge haven't fully analyzed yet. And that concerns me, because I think that there are, and I speak more broadly now, not just about the academic art of riding system. This is so true of many, many systems, even in Western riding and in horsemanship and even in clicker training. It's all the same. It's all the same at the end, because we are the same people applying things to the same animals, you know?
I think so, absolutely.
What are your thoughts about that?
Yes, I completely think that I think some people can use any kind of system and apply pressure to horses. And just because, you know, it's a system, it doesn't mean that it will prevent you from making any mistakes. Yeah. And I must say the people that I have met personally are often very self-reflective and willing to learn. And I think people are in different moments of their journey, different moments in life. And things are changing very fast for the horse industry, for horsemanship. Right now, I think we're in a moment where things are changing very, very fast. Not everybody can always keep up with it, I think, wants to keep up with it and maybe let go of old habits. And habits are really a bitch, you know, to get rid of. I know this from my own experience. I still have a habit sneaking up on me that I actually don't want, you know.
I'll share with you one of my bad habits. I'll throw my hat in the ring on this conversation. This is one of my bad habits that I'm seeking to eliminate. In the past, I went to natural horsemanship because it sold us this vision that through a better relationship with the horse, you can have more successful riding and you can get what you want from the horse if you've got a better relationship. Look at the principle there. The principle is relationship with the horse as a leverage tool to get better compliance. This is one of my bad habits of using that as a way to stay safe. I didn't use a stick or a whip to stay safe, but in the environments I was in, where everyone was in a state of emergency, especially the horses, instead of forcing them with sticks and fear and pain, I was like, let me rapidly and extremely powerfully connect with you emotionally so that we can be safe for the next 2 hours when I have to work with you and I don't have the choice. So that's been my leverage tool. It hasn't been a curb bit, but it's been my leverage tool. And I have very specific, extremely powerful training techniques, which can develop this with the horse. And so what I'm leaning into now as an instructor is celebrating when the horse gives you nothing that you want, nothing at all. And someone says, oh, but I say, yes, exactly. That's exactly where we need to be. We need to be in that place of absolute listening to the horse's perspective first. And if we get more compliance later and togetherness, great, but it should never be as leverage. It should never be introduced so that you get what you want, because horses have been underneath the selfish thumb of people for too long. And I see the academic art of riding system absolutely, positively contributing to that conversation with exactly the same ethos. So, yeah.
Yeah, we do ask ourselves, does this horse need to be ridden? You know, what are the problems that this horse has, and is it fixable? Is this horse really suitable for what we would like to do? And we can learn a lot from many horses, but it might not be the things that we want to learn. So I really think that we can learn so much from every single horse, but it might not be how to ride Piaffe. It might be something else, such as how to see where my horse is in the nervous system and how can I work on myself so my horse can accept me better and so on. These might not be the things we want to work on. This is what I see in the academic art is it's okay not to ride your horse. You can ride your horse if you like and your horse wants to be ridden. And we have something to offer for people who do want to work on the ground, for horses who can't be ridden for some purpose, for some reason, but also just really good basic work. It doesn't always have to be, you know, the highest of the highest, just to, yeah, that your horse gets a bit more supple, more balanced. This is great. And you can ride out better. And you can, if you and your horse, you enjoy the woods and you like to go for a good gallop. A little bit of basic work will help you to do this just a little bit better. Yeah. So it's not necessary that everybody, like we do, we have also some, we don't have competitions, but we have tests in the academic art, but you don't have to do it. It's just a thing you can do for yourself. And it's not, you're not being forced to do it. And that's what I like about it. And it's also, there are a lot of people who know a lot, and they're often not so present, maybe on social media, but they can do stuff with their horses sometimes. You know, you think like, whoa, amazing. And they let go of the reins and the horse is just standing there like, ah, cool, look what I could do. and it's that kind of ease which really attracted me also. And yeah, and then there are people who are just really happy with the basic work. And it's not that they are something lesser because, you know, they didn't want to go all the way. And they probably, sometimes we don't have a horse that we can do it with. Yes, there are limitations, and we have limitations. I have limitations in my body and in my mind. And for me right now, the academic art is so appealing in that way, because I think we can, very often, maybe not always, but we can accept those limitations, or we can recognize them. Sometimes it might take a bit longer. I'm not totally free from that. So, but I think it is that ability to just say, I don't have to do it. I don't have to do anything with my horse. So we can just spend time together. Yeah. Sometimes not even that. Sometimes you might need a break from your horse and things altogether. And the bad weather in Poland might help you with that. So sometimes I feel like I feel really depressed because the weather's so bad. But then sometimes I had to have a break from things, and it turned out to be a good thing because I got a bit of.
Come visit us in Spain. We got some sunshine.
Oh man,
you don't.
Oh man, this just sounds so good right now. I mean, it's just miserable here. It's not even bad weather. It's just miserable. Oh my god.
We got another period of rain now, but that rain only started a few days ago. And prior to that, we had 3.5 weeks of between 7 and 10 degrees, up to 16 degrees Celsius, and sun every day. And it was green and fresh.
I don't want to hear it.
For January, it was out of this world. Yeah, I feel very smug about that as someone who also lived in Poland for a while, and I know exactly of what you speak. I remember riding out in minus 12 for trail rides thinking, is this really what I want to be doing? It's pretty cold, you know. Anyway, I so agree with you, and I really see academic art of riding in the bigger picture of things. I really see it being dressage for the modern horse person. It really is that if a modern discerning horse person who really wants to put their horse first, if they are interested in dressage, this is really the system where they need to be learning it. Almost par excellence. Almost no other system is able to teach it with the balance of thought and humanness and humaneness and fun and calmness that I think the academic art of riding is bringing to it. So as far as I'm concerned, even though I'm a horsemanship instructor, but I've got very private classical riding ambitions, but I'm a horsemanship instructor with a trail riding background, I put my shoulder fully into the yoke to celebrate what you guys are doing over there. Mariusz and Bent and all of you, what you're doing over there is just, it's fabulous. It really is. Fabulous.
Thank you.
You've taken dressage and you've said, let's just strip it of the drama and the bullshit and present it as it should have always been. My criticism, maybe sometimes we don't need to have the mustaches and the coats and the capes and the hats. And some people are turned off by that. I love the costume of it. It's fun.
Well, everyone has their own style.
Sure. Okay, so we're going to start winding up, and I promise that we'd have some little segments to discuss. And the first one is what the muck, that there's a steaming pile of something in the corner of the equestrian industry that we can muck out. What would you like to muck out with me today, Bettina?
That's a pretty big pile. I would love to muck out competitions.
Altogether?
Mm-hmm. In the way of that there's anything to win. Because I think that often gets the better of us. And as soon as you know it, you're in that system and you're depending on that system. And there's a lot of, you know, money involved, fame involved. And I think we can... It's no problem when people measure their abilities. I'm not sure if we should do it with horses. that's just not what I'm sure about. So like I said, I mean, we do have tests in the academic art. You can show what you can do if you like. And they are not easy also. So you can knock yourself out learning your whole life. But it is it's more like you have a competition with yourself. You try to be better this year than you were last year. And you try to make progress in the sense of you might get progress in exercises, but it's also the softness you want to improve. You want to improve the basic. Well, you know that when you are when you're working on something advanced, you just want to improve the basics all the time. This is, as soon as you become a little bit more advanced writer, this is all you want to do. You want to have better basics. And I sometimes think that this competition system, it prevents people from refining the basics more and more and going for what's rewarded. And at the moment, I don't see that it's so useful what's being rewarded. And that they, what I see, that there's a big difference between the lower level competitions when there is an eye on how you're supposed to do things, and then the higher competitions when you think like, what is happening here? And I'm so glad people start talking about it. And I'm also glad that you are asking difficult questions also about the academic art of writing. And even if I might feel slightly uncomfortable about it, but I think these are questions we have to ask ourselves if we want to keep working with horses and do the things we love and the things that we think bring meaning into this world. So I know that people might not be happy when I say something like that. I know that some of my students compete, and if they want to do that, that's fine with me, seriously, because I know they're good people and I know they will not overwhelm their horses and, you know, ride a 3.5-year-old in a test that's not age appropriate. So I do have a problem with the age limits, for example. I do have a problem with the fast education of the horses, with the goal orientation of the education.
There is no age-appropriate dressage test for a horse under the age of at least 7, in my opinion.
I think so too, yeah.
Because at 3, their pelvis is only very recently conjoined into 2 rather than 4 parts. You know, I so agree with you. And you're a little bit more braver than I am there to just straight up say, yep, want to say goodbye to competitions. And honestly, I tend to agree with you.
I know it's not realistic, but...
I know. I tend to agree with you.
Yeah. I just think that for many people, this kind of system doesn't bring out the best in them. I think that's all.
I agree. And listen, I ask difficult questions of myself first before I ever ask them of other people. That's just how I am. That we've got to find ways to ask these difficult questions, especially from the people that we respect. Because if we can't ask difficult questions of the people we respect and like, how can we ask difficult questions of ourselves and remain accountable in our horsemanship? Because we do have a responsibility, you know, to these animals in the middle who are vulnerable in our hands and in our care, because they are so graceful, they are so generous, they are so forgiving that they can and will tolerate some of the most horrific practices and give all of the signs and symptoms at a shallow level, aesthetically, of loving what they do. But if we scratch the surface a little deeper and ask a harder question, we discover, this horse might feel leveraged into this position, actually. What if I just stripped that off? What's really sitting there under the surface? Is this horse happy to serve, or is this horse agitated to serve? What's the difference? What is the difference? And that these are the big questions I'm going to intend to continue to unfurl here in my work.
Yeah, totally. So. Yeah, and I have the same feeling about my work. It's that I also... I'm so happy with where I am now, and I'm so curious where I will be in a few years, because I know I will uncover some things and some try to throw out some habits that I have and things like that. And it makes me just excited because I love the connection I have with my horses now, and I know I can do better still, and I'm really curious where this leads me, I must say.
To Spain? Please. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about it. Okay. So my next question is, the whole conversation has been about this, but more succinctly, how are you contributing to the tides of change in the equestrian industry in your way? How are you contributing?
I travel around in the world. I give clinics. I try to help everyone I meet to connect better to their horses, understand them better. I learn from those meetings a lot myself, so try to better myself in that way as well. I read the books that come out. I participate in our meetings in the knighthood. I give webinars, trying to educate people. I have a classroom where people can subscribe with videos. I'm looking for...
You're a teacher. You are a teacher and a mentor.
Mm-hmm. I'm teaching and I'm working on becoming better myself. Yeah. So I think there's nothing else I can do. So, and that's something I also can't really stop doing. So, just in general, like you said, just being a teacher, and I'm writing a lot on my Facebook. I just write what I have in my head. So most of my posts are not really, I don't really think about it a lot. Sometimes I just, I have a thought and I write it down and I send it off, and just hoping to connect to some people who are like, hey, yeah, you know, that's interesting. And it brought me, you know, also here on this podcast, and then I can hear all your cool ideas.
I've got some bad ideas too. I promise you, I've got plenty of bad ideas. You know, I don't know where this question's coming from, but, and I'm just going to ask it. Do you get tired as a teacher at the coalface of delivering services and clinics and coaching and webinars and integrating in your knighthood community with the other instructors and everything that you are doing? Do you get tired? That's a yes or no answer.
Of course, yes. Yeah.
I don't speak just of physical tired at the end of the day, like, oh, I'll go to bed. But have you ever had a crisis of thought where you're just like, this is just,
Yes, I think so many times, but this is more when I'm thinking about myself and when I'm then in the situation and I go and I meet my students, then I can't help but go on, you know, so.
Okay, so for me, huge relief.
Of course, when I'm sometimes sitting in the evening on my couch, I'm like, oh man, why didn't I just become a banker? I'd have a lot more money in my account. Oh, Jesus, you know, not so many difficult things. Sometimes it's difficult. It's emotionally difficult sometimes. What bothers me most is when I have a student and a horse that are struggling. It follows me, you know, a student losing a horse or things like that, yeah. Something happening to a student in their personal life. So it follows me to my life as well. So I'm not like, okay, I'm, you know, in this 30 minutes, I'm your teacher, and what happens in the rest of the time, it doesn't interest me. So I think when you're a sensitive person, then yeah, sometimes it's hard. But I think it's also a part of life, and it's also beautiful in a way. So things come together and they grow, and that's exciting, and it feels easy. And then sometimes things fall apart and they disappear, and that feels difficult very often to us, but it is, it's just part of the cycle of existence. And yes, it is sometimes hard. And then I either switch on my computer and meet a student in an online lesson, and I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I did this. Or I'm traveling somewhere and I'm getting out of the plane and I'm really tired. And then I'm like, oh my God, I'm so glad I came here. So yeah, that's how it is. How is it with you? Do you get tired?
It's exactly the same. When I said a huge relief, I have relief because I relate to that experience intimately. So I'll be really, really tired. I'll be having an existential crisis about my horsemanship or my coaching abilities or something. And then I'll log on to a lesson for a client and I'll take a breath and I exit myself. I'm no longer myself. I'm no longer thinking about me.
I know exactly what you mean, and I do that too.
Yeah. And it just, you just enter this flow state. And sometimes I think back, I'm like, where did that correction come from?
Where did that come from?
I had this out of body experience where I turn and look at myself and I give myself a nudge with the elbow and I say, yeah, that was pretty good. Like, well,
you know,
done
even
with that.
Sometimes you students know? Tell me, you know, some time ago you told me this and this. And I'm like, that's really smart.
Really?
I said that.
Like, oh. I said that. Yeah. I've had clinics.
That's
like,
so funny.
When I did a clinic in Switzerland last year, the end of a 10 clinic tour in Canada, USA, and then I went to Switzerland, and I'd had a really bad budget flight from New York over to Frankfurt, then down to Zurich, which was delayed. And I didn't sleep a wink on the flight over. Don't fly Condor Airways, everyone. Transatlantic, don't recommend. They're a subsidiary of Lufthansa. Don't recommend it. Anyway, I arrived in Switzerland and in the hotel before the clinic, I looked myself in the mirror and I said, do you have the gas in the tank to do this? Because I really don't know if I do. I was bone tired. But I decided to show up. I had my chair. Usually I'm walking around at the clinics, but I decided to sit down most of the day at this clinic. And I just sort of locked into my skill set and I was able to deliver, I hope, what was a pleasant experience for everybody there. No one had any disasters. Even some people had some minor breakthroughs. So I was delighted. But I think it's important as coaches that we ask each other again these hard questions, such as, do you get tired and what do you do there? Because we have to lean on each other and be honest about what's going on and learn from
each other. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, for me, it's the clinic environment is I feel that this is my space, you know. And I don't know if you know this, sometimes a horse and a person come in and you look at them and for the first moment you have no idea what to do. And then what I do is I just, like you said, I just
go outside my body.
Yeah, for me it's like I don't focus on anything for a moment. This is how I would describe it. So and this is what I said in the beginning, that trust in space. So I will just try to I take a deep breath. I will also sit sometimes then. And then I will just not think. I will try to not think about anything for a moment, and just also make a deep wish that I could help the horse and the person, and I trust that I will be. And then something comes. It's for me. It's always a miracle, because that's what I said. That for me, it is all there in space. And the thing is, do I get access to it or not? Yeah. And then sometimes being very tired makes it but it also can make it difficult because then I can sometimes just see my own ideas. But when you are then really tired, you forget about yourself because there's just no way you can keep this up. And then some interesting things can happen as well. And for me, but then I also try to learn from the situation. So I'm like, okay, I'm back home. And I notice, okay, here I came very close to not functioning. Why? What can I do better? Because I'm no help of, you know, for anyone if I'm.
Yes.
I can't pick up myself. You know, yes. So, and I think the people in the clinic, they do rely on me because they, in my, I don't think they came in order to get a show or anything, yeah, or some miracle tips or something, but they came because they trust me with their horse and their work. And they have a certain openness for learning. Yeah. So that's something that I really want to respect, and I want to respect their time and the money that they pay me. So I try to be in the best shape that I can be. So I might have to do some choices. I'm really sorry. I will not drink wine with you today because I know I have to get up in the morning and I have people waiting on the clinic. And I need to give them the best version of myself. Yeah. So, and then whenever I feel like, okay, this was really hard for me and I had to pull myself, you know, up, you know, from my hair, I really try to sit down and think, okay, Bettina, why is it the case? Yeah, and I try to do it better. Yeah. And that might mean that I sometimes have to make some choices. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. I have a strict no drinking policy when I'm doing clinics, and I get a lot of sleep.
Australian wine is so good. So it's really mean, you know.
So is Spanish wine, by the way. So is Spanish wine.
And it's cheap.
So like I really relate to that quite a bit. And for me, also, the logistics of the clinic are really important. So I try to now be very discerning who I'm clinicking with, and select hosts and environments where the logistics are exceptionally well organized. Because if it's chaos at the event, I'm too busy putting out fires and making sure everyone's where they need to be. And I'm spending energy I don't need to spend prior to the event. And I try to make sure that all I do on the day is wake up, have breakfast, read my dossiers on all the people who are going to be there, so I know their names and their horses. And then I show up and I teach. I don't do anything else. I don't answer emails. I'm not helping check in. Nothing. Just be only for that. Because yeah, it's expensive. Clinics are expensive for us to do. You know, it's 65-70% expenses to show up in North America for me. So yeah, you've got to do the work in a disciplined way and take care of yourself. But I don't recommend doing 10 clinics one after the other in 3 countries. I've learned my lesson there. I sort of had to because of my year, my calendar sort of worked out that way. But anyway, I digress. Okay, Bettina, we're going to wrap it up now with the final segment. The final segment is the whole point of our conversation today. I'd like you to take me home. So take us home with you. What is home for you with horses?
For me, home is the feeling between us. I think if I would have to put it in one sentence, it's the feeling between us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I had horrible news this week with my heart horse.
I read, I'm so sorry.
With cancer. And I allowed myself 24 hours to be sad. It's not fair. Couldn't get out of bed. But then I went downstairs and I stood in the field and he looked at me. And I shared the video on my social media. He just looked straight through me to me. Pure unconditional love. And I thought, especially if I've got limited time left, why would I spend this time making our home a horrible place to be? So that is home for me too, regardless what they do. It's how the horse feels about us that is the most important aspect of horsemanship for me. So I'm happy to hear it's the same for you. Well, Bettina, thank you. Where can people find you if they want to find you and learn dressage, according to Academic Art of Riding, with Bettina's beautiful, elegant Buddhist take on Academic Art of Riding?
Yeah. So I have a website. It's academicartofriding.pl. I'm located in Poland, but I travel around to clinics if you invite me. You can contact me through the webpage. Also, I'm on Facebook, Academic Art of Riding, Bettina Bialik. And I have an online classroom as well. You can find that on classroom.academicartofriding.pl. So that's on my page. You can find it there. I'm also represented in the Online Academy, which is a video platform of the Academic Art of Riding. So I have a lot of courses there. If you're more the course person, you know, not a subscriber person. So I have courses about groundwork and launch work there. So about straightness and all sorts of things, and also individual webinars that can be bought. And that is the Online Horse Academy, in German, Online Reitschule. Yeah, so you can find me there as well.
Beautiful. Bettina, thank you for gracing us with your presence today. It's been wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. I could have done this for a lot longer, and it was beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Emotional Horsemanship Podcast. I am your host, Lucky Phillips, and that was my guest, Bettina Bialik. If you'd like to learn more about Bettina Biolik, you can find her website in the show notes below. Thank you for being here, and I look forward to seeing you next time. Be kind to yourselves and to your horses. Be safe out there.